research data sets, which may have considerable structural or not. One project that we're going to be working on in the upcoming year, to give you an example of the sorts of content that these spaces is assimilating, is there's another initiative at MIT called OpenCourseWare, whose goal, perhaps some of you have heard, course content up on the web, all the MIT courses being offered. And they've selected these spaces as a repository so that when course content is no longer active, it's going to get put into the vSpace repository. So again, there we're going to have to, deal with issues of taking the whole website and structured digital objects and preserving them. There is a workflow built into vSpace, and that's basically for capturing and validating the metadata associated with the objects going in. And it's a fairly flexible, but reasonably simple system of steps of editors and approvers and so forth. Again, I won't go into it too much, except to note that metadata we use is qualified W4, which is, I know, is being discussed quite a bit here. The data model is very quickly a hierarchy of a community. Within a given vSpace installation, would represent, in MIT's terms, a research institute, a department, and so forth. The policy entity, okay, that decides what objects get accepted into the collection, and so forth. Below that, there's a series of collections, which are logically related groups of digital objects. We call those digital objects items, and the items are the objects with which the DC metadata is associated, and to which, and we'll come back to this in a minute, a permanent identifier is assigned. And that's also another, in terms of the next point, that's another main design consideration of vSpace, storage of digital objects. And for that reason, a permanent identifier, supposedly to survive even URL notation and everything else. We selected the CNRI handle system. I don't know if you've heard of that. Although there are other options for permanent identifiers. I can describe that if people are interested. The DNS style distributed
hash, this ID.
I'm sorry?
The unique ID is hash-based, or it's assigned other considerations?
No, it's just a numerical identifier, and there's a central name.
So it's got to be distributed?
Yes, it is. Like I say, it's DNS style. It's distributed. What you get from the, from the central registry is an identifier unique to your repository. You locally assign identifiers. And then there's a resolution mechanism that works very much like DNS. So look up. It goes to the main server and it delegates to a local resolver, which vSpace is. So, it was also designed for open access, and I think I've hesitated to use the term archive when we use terms like repository, and so forth, because I think the association of an archive is someplace where it's buried and kept for posterity, but not really exposed. The idea of vSpace is very much the opposite, that we provide a lot of tools to expose the metadata, and so that it is a usable and reusable source of digital content. Having said that, the goal is open access. There also are mechanisms to restrict access. For instance, in the academic community, there's sometimes patent and copyright issues that force us to have items in the archive not be exposed maybe for 6 months or a year or whatever. So access control is desired. And finally, it's designed to be a platform for creating what we can think of as federated services. Okay. vSpace itself was built with the model of an institutional archive, someplace like MIT or university or a foundation. But clearly you're going to want at some point to aggregate content and metadata from a number of these sites. So the tools and the hooks are in the vSpace to do just that. You can logically aggregate metadata from a number of them and create subject-based rather than institution-based representations of the digital objects. You could, again, one thing we're looking into is generating replication sets, because with repositories, I guess we're typically talking about very large multi-terabyte storage problems. And rather than local redundancy, we're looking at cross-repository replication schemes. And again, those can be thought of as federations or aggregations of the platform. Okay, the attempt was made in the design, I think largely succeeded, to make it as standard space as we possibly could so we can interoperate with other components of the space. Cloud-based middleware, I guess is the best way to put it. It uses SQL to a database. We package and describe its use with Postgres, and there are a couple of Postgres-specific calls in it, but with very little effort, it could be made to work with MySQL, commercial databases, or all the like. There's no real strong requirement or constraint on the database system. And this is for storage of the metadata, if you understand, not visual objects. Okay? I mentioned the handles before, so I won't go into it again. The authentication is largely actually outside of vSpace. It's sort of a trust model, since there the design contemplates a number of access methods to the archive. We have shipped with a web UI access method, and that uses digital certificates. But the architecture would support any number of access methods, and authentication is sort of done outside of vSpace, and it's trusted within.
Question about the database. Did you consider using an OVS store like Jada instead of using RDF?
Well, interestingly enough, there is an RDF store in there, but not for the metadata. And I think I'll touch upon that in a subsequent slide, but that also leads into the simile discussion.
We'll hear about that.
Yeah. There is, and again, I'm not, please stop me if some of these standards are unfamiliar to this audience. There's a lot of libraries in there. They're peculiar standards worlds. But the idea is that the metadata is exposed, and we offer one system, which is OAI, which is the Open Archives Initiative, has a standard called the Protocol for Metadata Harvesting. Support that. It's a library that's built in, and it's a way of exposing the metadata to what are called harvesters, bots, that sort of thing, that collect metadata so that the contents of the repository are known. We also intend to support another large emerging standard, which is called METS. Have people heard of things like METS? That's a Library of Congress metadata encoding and transmission standard, and it is very useful for the exchange of digital objects and metadata. So they define what are called information packages, which are digital objects together with their metadata, structural and descriptive and administrative metadata. There's not currently support in vSpace for METS, but that's on the table. So that will provide a useful mechanism for transfer of digital content and objects among repositories, between repository and a content management system. For some reason, I want to raise the METS issue. Because that might be something you want to look at as a standards-based exchange protocol. Again, it's not really a technology stack. This is so much essentially what the bundle components are.
Yep. What does MET stand for?
Metadata Encoding and Transmission Standard.
Does that go over HTTP here?
It can, but it's not an HTTP protocol. It's
an XML scheme.
Yeah, it's a okay. Schema-based protocol. Mm-hmm.
Do you have set 30
No, that's also, Yeah, Z3950 is also an obvious protocol to support. So anyway, in terms, again, DSpace is middle, and it sits, there's a relational database below, a web server above. We document a particular constellation of those, and that's what's on this one. But having said that, none of this is required to have DSpace. Just to take the top item, we document the use of Apache Tomcat simply because it's very standard. However, many DSpace adopters have also selected JBoss Jetty. It was originally prototyped on Resin, which is a commercial server. No, the DC metadata. At this point, yes, and again, Simile is going to address the question of multiple and arbitrary metadata in a similar repository. Yes, it's DC only. And that is, to be honest, that's one of the limitations, I think, of the DSpace architecture currently. But for the purpose it was intended, qualified double support is perfect for the kind of scholarly material that was the original target.
Very atomic
operation. But it's available. Like I said, I'm trying to stick to real high level perspective. And then a quick word on the storage API, because vSpace, again, as I alluded, deals with a world where very large storage requirements. At the moment, the only thing that we've implemented below the storage API is what we ship as a bitstream storage manager. And it's a very simple system of writing to a Unix file system or multiple file systems. But the idea is, as time grows and repositories grow, there'll probably be more sophisticated implementations of this API to support highly scalable distributed storage systems, you know, that easily handle multi-hundred terabyte scales.
Control company.
other questions? I don't mean to monopolize this talk. I'm sorry.
One of your slides mentioned haystack. How does that, is there efforts to bring those two together?
Nickelback.
PSD.
I thought you were going to mention that you were meeting the license. There's also copyright issues that occur during the workflow, because what we have is a click-through license. There are all kinds of intellectual property issues about the objects, you know, the digital content that's going into the repository or coming out of it. And we have a click-through license built into the, and actually, interesting, the license is stored along with the bit stream. For permanent storage. But again, that's a detailed workflow, I might say, a little bit. Thanks very much.
So just offer a couple of really high-level modus operandi comments here. The System D space had its genesis at the intersection between an institutional need and a real place like MIT, saying, we're this library, we have all these constituents, increasingly they're showing up our doorstep with digital assets, and they're in really, really different formats, really, really different ways of describing this stuff, lots of different communities. What do? And so we started with a commitment to create a system that could be operational. And this required us to do some pretty serious soul searching and partitioning about, okay, well, there's a ton of really interesting stuff that's like squarely in the research domain. It's on topic there. But we also actually wanted to, you know, ground it in some really real use cases. We wanted to produce a system that MIT libraries would be able to use when they had a need, a real need, that exists within the institution. And so, that the right thing to do was to focus on getting vSpace shipped and out the door in an open source manner so we can start to collaborate with people who are interested in applying it while keeping in mind some of the more research-oriented topics, which I'll talk about now. And so having gotten vSpace completed, we turned our attention back to some of the very interesting, and I think at this point in time, right, research opportunities with respect to data. And so we said, okay, we've got vSpace, it's on the ground, it's working in MIT libraries. Who are the other collaborators that we should be pulling here? HP Labs has been a participant from the beginning with vSpace, and HP actually has some significant development contribution and activity in open source in the Spanish web community. So there's a toolkit that's authored in the Bristol, United Kingdom called Gemma. And there's a network API to Gemma called Yoseki that also comes from Bristol. And these toolkits are really good at modeling really flexible metadata. And so we wanted to bring those to bear. There's also a team in Palo Alto working on a persistent back-end store for the Gemma REX toolkit. And that team is called the Genesis team, and then we also have a team in Cambridge that's working directly with MIT. In addition to that, we wanted to pull in some faculty from the lab for computer science, so it turns out that David Carter, who leads the Haystack project, has an existing personal information management system that allows you to provide unified views on really diverse data types and information types. And it's completely constructed on top of RDF. So we found that pretty interesting. We've got a lot of experience in application of RDF. And then, of course, Eric Miller from the Web Consortium, user semantic web activity and steers and governors there. And we wanted to include someone like Eric in the Web Consortium, because if you know Eric, he's like a gatekeeper, you know, like all the people in the world who are doing interesting work in this area. So we wanted to make sure that we weren't operating in a vacuum, and Eric helped us to make sure that we're succeeding in the mission. And then Kansas Smith is the director of technology from the libraries. And we wanted McKenzie to be involved in the project because, again, the objective in Simile is to apply semantic web and RDF techniques to get real benefit to a real community of users, MIT libraries, who have real faculty coming up to the doorstep, and you've got these digital objects using the data that's using with them. And we put them in your system, and can you offer any hope of providing stewardship for those things over time? Now, this presents a bunch of issues that we'll talk about now. So why Simile? Well, Webster says this is the word or phrase by which one thing is likened in one of its aspects, or maybe multiple aspects, to something else. And it turns out that that's really appropriate in terms of this project, because we're talking about metadata that came from one source and an asset that came from another, and like kind of put it together and get it to work together. This is just a picture of the landscape. These are the nouns and the context in which the nouns exist. So if you're MIT libraries, you've got people showing up saying, I've got this set of documents, or I've got all these images, or I've got a bunch of videos and lectures, or I've got a bunch of course materials, or I've got these data sets. So they're the assets themselves. But then you've also got descriptive mechanisms, like languages, essentially, that communities have agreed upon that are used to annotate practices. And then you've also got instances, metadata that's performance in the schema that then is applied to the asset. So I think most people in this room understand these nouns, but further, you've got this organizational context stuff, right? So not all schemas come from the same place. Typically, schemas are developed in different communities, and they may or may not know about one another. But you've also got schemas that are up at this institutional level that may have to do about how do we preserve these assets, what's the set of information that we need to keep on hand to understand what transformation is undergoing. And so really, when a community shows up at MIT Library, please take my assets and please take my metadata, what they're saying is, we want you to offer at the institutional level the capability of some guarantee about stewardship for these assets and these schemas and these instances that you can create yourself. And so we need some standard way of talking about, well, what is a schema and how do I hand that off? And how do I approach an existing archival content management system and have a dialogue about what I'm going to do to support that schema, and what does it mean to support that schema. And then, just to make things even more complicated, you've got individual humans in the mix. And one of the things David Carver points out is that oftentimes, assets and metadata are authored down here. There's some real power that you can get if you can combine in some way the schemas and instance metadata that individual users are creating through their use of the system or through their description of the system with this institutional stuff. But the friction between crossing between these contexts is incredibly high, because in the industry today, as I said, there's not a real good way to talk about how do I hear about these schemas. XML schema helps, RDF arguably can help. There's a raft of issues which we'll talk about. So, yes.
One thing I don't see there is rendering technologies. So, is there any move to kind of capture whatever it was that rendered this thing in the first place, so that's not lost as well?
Yeah, that's an excellent point. And so, there's actually slightly more complex version of this slide that has two additional bars. We'll talk about it since you asked. If you look at all these things, these are kind of platonic, right? So it's that paper that you wrote, or it's that image that's got a picture of Mount Everest in it, or it's the major record in that scene. But in the end, all of that stuff has to get manifested into reality in some way. And it has to get stored on like real hardware somewhere. And so there's another bar here that's called services that maybe would you render it, or maybe would rendering on a particular device, right? And then next services, this provisioning, disks, servers, all of that stuff. So if your goal is to keep this stuff useful over time, you have to preserve sort of, you know, the platonic stuff, instead of, you know, the picture of Mount Everest and the ways of describing it so that people can find it, decide if it's useful. But you also have to manage the services that are associated with it. Where is that picture currently stored? And how am I going to decide when it needs to be moved? Because that somebody's about to take that disk offline. And what's the service that I use to render that picture? Do I count on that being a service that I know that the individual has, or is that a service that I have to provide up here? So you've got to cover exactly that entire spectrum.
How much of a real deal are you having this storage?
So in DSpace, there are several thousand at this point, mostly articles, research reports, output for research projects,
mostly gigabytes.
So the store is currently sized at a little less than a terabyte. So I don't know, 600 gigabytes.
That's just one. You know, other network that combined increases the storage requirements.
So very much like what's happening at MIT is you've got Mackenzie, who I mentioned, director for technology, having conversations with specific individuals in the departments about the kinds of assets that they have and what the impact on storage requirements, what kind of schemas need to be supported, right? So she'll talk to somebody and they'll say, I've got all these biomedical images, I've got brain slices, right? And so I have a schema that I use with a bunch of instance metadata that people in my department actually use to describe these brain slices. And then institutions have to take decisions about, okay, what's the deal that we're going to strike? Maybe we can support your schema and your metadata and host that long term, but as a library, we're not willing to pay for the storage to host the assets themselves, so you can keep those. So again, you're looking at what kinds of deals do you have to make as you cross these boundaries? And you want both a technology-based mechanism so that once you decide on the deal, you can actually implement it at a low cost. But you also need to, you know, think about who's actually going to step up to the plate and be responsible for what pieces. I'll come back to this in just a minute. I'm going to show you this next picture next. So we say, all right, we've got DSpace, it exists, but there's all the stuff that it doesn't do. So it doesn't support multiple schemas right now. You can submit to DSpace a serialization of some metadata, and it will store it for you. And it will even store it in such a way that you can know that it's a serialization of metadata in a particular format. It won't let you query it. You can export it into some other system that might query it. It would be nice if DSpace as a service would let you do that. So there are all of these techniques in the semantic web and application of RDF that come from other research that we have going on in these labs that we think are applicable. So there's some techniques that we think could be applied to use cases that exist in this MIT environment. So, you know, we've got a researcher that has brain slices and they want to put them in DSpace. We've got lots of learning objects that are coming from open courseware. I'd like to be able to support those more easily in DSpace. We've got naming authority issues when people submit I wrote this paper in DSpace. It's not validated particularly well right now. There are services on the outside that could be used to annotate that. So what we'd like to do is find use cases that give us the opportunity to explore these technology-based approaches. And if we keep the use cases real, then we'll know that as we apply these approaches, if they work, it actually means something. And then, you know, David Carter has his interests and agenda, as does MIT Libraries. These people all have, like, you know, real customers that are happy. Those are going to guide a selection of different architectural alternatives. And then, you know, by the end of the year, we're going to have a set of demonstrators, some of which I'll describe, that are on the table, that we can look at and say, okay, we've demonstrated some of these techniques. They seem to be working. These are the areas and the standards that are like maybe fully absent where people need to talk some more. I'm going to talk about metadata and content metadata services just for a few moments, because this is an area where, with respect to application of RDF and expanded web, there are a ton of opportunities here. And I just want to illustrate some of the kinds of services that can be brought to bear. And the almost frightening complexity of what you need to do if you're an institutional role, and you say, okay, I'm going to offer support for your instances and your metadata over the long term, because it's a moving target. All right, so somebody might give me content. There are content services that I could offer. I could augment their content. If they give me pictures, I might want to be able to have content-based services that, like, do edge extraction, that sharpen the images, etc. So there's a bunch of products that might do that. It might be nice to, if you're a library institution, to be able to bring some of those kinds of services to bear within this framework. It can also be content transformation. So faculty members submitted a PDF, it gets converted to full text, or Microsoft Word gets submitted, full text gets extracted, and PDF gets generated. You give me PowerPoint, and it gets converted to slide MO, right? Lots of examples. With respect to metadata, somebody give me Dublin Core for this dSpace item, and I want to augment it in some way. I want to make it better. So I want to take author that they submitted and cross-check it against these authority files or registries, and add an annotation that says that John Smith is really the John Smith that went to Harvard Law School and came back to Harvard in 2019 this year. There's also metadata extraction. There might be metadata embedded in that article, and I want to get it out and make it explicit in the metadata that's associated with the guidance, equal management services to do that. Dynamic metadata. I could do that extraction and then store the metadata, or I might actually have a piece of code that runs every time on the asset. So for example, you can say, I can have a piece of code that says, show me pictures that are basically red rather than pictures that are basically blue. So this is a technique that happens in object relational databases. It could also apply here. Data mining. Here I'm interested not in extracting metadata about a particular object or instance, but in drawing conclusions about the relationships across a large number of instances. And in the context of dSpace, this could be useful. You could say, we've got lots of faculty-authored articles that are about this gene. So find me, based on noun phrases that are extracted from these articles, go tell me the ones that are probably about this gene. And there's some well-founded techniques that you can apply there. Metadata generation. So this is where it's metadata is coming from new sources, and like the most trivial and simple example is coming from the unit, it's like looking at any type of unit. But it might also be coming from a service that's pulling from an outside source and annotating the item. And then metadata presentation. You asked about item views. Well, when you've got people now submitting their own schemas and instances that are annotating these objects, you also need to worry about how am I going to present that metadata so that people can actually use it to decide if this is information that's of interest to them. So with respect to instance data and schemas, there's some further breakdown. Of course, you have schemas, and like the simplest instance of XML schema, where it's hierarchical, or REF schema. Sometimes it's more complex. There are all these ontology languages, OWL, web ontology language, YAML plus OIL, where you're talking about modeling in a more complete way the language and discourse in a particular field. And then on the outside, it pulls you all the way into artificial intelligence, where you're reasoning about things based on statements that are made in these languages. then you can have instance data that conforms to a schema. So I might say, okay, my schema is Dublin 4, here's my instance. My schema is IMS SCORM, here's my instance. And you might want to validate that the instance data that you've got actually conforms to that schema because the networks and so on. And then there are all these controlled vocabularies. So Library of Congress, name authority file, standard subject headings. There are controlled vocabularies that list standard course disciplines. Schema diversity. You get schemas from all kinds of different communities for all kinds of different purposes. So some of these are descriptive, which is primarily to help you find things. But some of them are much more technical. They're provided by agents. And the reason that the agent is producing this instance metadata is they're expecting some other agent to consume it down the road. So really you're interoperating, but not through an API, but through these schemas. Information lifecycle. Okay, all about schemas. So schemas come from somewhere. Where do they come from? So a community says, we've got all these brain scan images. So how are we gonna work together and talk about these images? So they might ask, is there anybody else out there that's developed a schema that seems to be about brain scan images or biomedical stuff? Or what are the attributes about the schema that we would use to decide if we should leverage somebody else's community-based schema or whether we should write our own community-based needs? You can't really mandate these kinds of things. Those guys are going to decide on their own. And in a system like DSpace, if you're MIT Library, it's in your best interest to give them the tools that they need to find an existing schema if, in fact, it's there. Because otherwise, you're going to be merging these things later on. Schema creation. So once I figure out, okay, nothing out there that really meets my needs, how am I going to create this schema? And one of the big issues, I think, with application of RDF in a platform like DSpace is the community is like defining the discourse. They're typically not computer scientists. And so tools that make it really easy to create a schema and validate it, or consulting models where you're pairing up people in the language of discourse with consultants in the library using some tools to allow them to bring the schema to bear, this is going to be really useful. Schema evolution. One of the really difficult things about schemas is we'll say, this is my worldview, I'll codify it in a schema. And I promise, I'm never ever going to change it. We're all going to agree and we're going to use this schema. Oh wait, we were wrong. And so people do change schemas. And you do have instance data that was written in an old schema that then needs to either be migrated forward into the new schema or you need to have inference rules in that particular schema in the new schema. So you get to decide, do I version the data or do I write rules? And what are the implications of a system in a service like this? Open schemas versus closed. Lots of time check. 10 minutes? Can we borrow from lunch? Should we finish up? Who wants to finish up? Who wants to borrow from lunch? Okay. I'll finish this bit. People want to go to lunch can go. People want to stay, we'll carry on. Okay. So we talked about relationships and interoperability, about mapping, about validating. I've got this instance of this particular schema. How much is right? This can really help lower the cost of entry. If you've got humans entering metadata, it's really expensive because humans always tend to get it wrong. And if you're trying to automate, if you're trying to use technology, if I've got an agent that's outputting the schema, it's even more important to be able to validate it because they're not going to get offended if the software agent won't be offended if you say, that's not compliant. And if you don't do that, there's no way they don't know that it's got this data. Merging. I made this instance, and then a little bit later on, somebody else made some assertions about my object, and I got to figure out that now there are these multiple assertions that have been made about the same object. This is the same problem that happens with Outlook when you try to sync your PDA, like change the details of the calendar in different places. Naming. We talked about it in the use case. If we've got all these schemas, how are they referred to? We've got different versions of schemas, and how are they stuff together. This is a good break point. So we'll start to talk about Jedi and Jedi and architecture. So I think maybe I've succeeded in communicating some of the observations that we've arrived at in Sicily about what is this space all about? What's the range of problems? So there's this document, Sicily Research Drivers, URL over here. If you go to the Sicily website, web.mit.edu/Sicily, you can find all of these documents. web.mit.edu/Sicily. You can read about all of the pieces here, the technical approaches, and some of the sub-problems that you can solve in order for someone like MIT Libraries just to be able to offer a service where they say, I'll accept your community-specific statement and post your assets, no problem, we know how to do it. Now, given this set of use cases and this target set of techniques, how in Sicily are we going to go about actually making progress on any of these? So here's what we think we're going to do. So we acknowledge that there's kind of this hierarchy here. We've got like production down at the bottom, so e-space that's running at MIT with like real research outputs and real faculty members. It's in production. It's got in bulletproof style. And it's open source, and there's a community down here that's maintaining the space. And then there's a lot of the things that we're talking about here that are clearly, as yet, not completely solved. Really promising to apply these techniques in the context of open source, archival, content management systems. But we're going to need to build some prototypes that allow us to investigate some of these techniques kind of more in isolation, not necessarily in the context of the whole use-based system. And we'll write a bunch of tech reports based on the results from these prototypes. We envision these being pretty small, like 3 months, one person heads down, build a demo, try out a particular technique. So I've got this schema and that schema, and they're both like in demo plus oil, and I'm going to do combining and fixing certain problems. How will it work with this system? They capture that learning. Maybe we'll submit a piece. So a set of prototypes is not a use case made. And so we know that after we do this, we're going to have to go back to some of the use cases like support for learning objects and say, all right, we've got these techniques, and we think we understand how well each one of them works. And given that, we'll be able to combine them together to say, let's actually build a version of DSpace that has support for learning objects. And we'll do it in this way such that if IMS comes up with a new rev, we can accept that as well and support that as well. And so we'll build that. It's still kind of in the research space. And if it works pretty well, we can do some advanced engineering work, package, characterize hardware, and then release it in such a way that we would hope that the doctors of DSpace at other universities would say, that's really valuable, and it's sufficiently hardened that we're going to be willing to adopt it and deploy it in our institutions. All right, so what's this going to mean for the architects? You notice when Richard was speaking, there's no RDF store. There's a relational database that's completely for completely structured information. This is a really standard database, business logic, verification kind of an architecture. So we've got Delta Core and information about the DSpace data model that's stored over here in the relational database. Bit streams themselves are stored in an OPM fashion in the file system. So if we want to add support, say, for learning object metadata, where's it going to go? So there's kind of two choices here. You're either going to come up with some scheme where you're growing tables in the database, or you're going to use an OO database, or perhaps you can apply an RDF store. So we have one in HP, it's called Jenna. And so our plan is to apply Jenna, and in first instance, we'll apply Jenna with a Postgres or SQL backend. So instead of adding to the tables over here, we'll add a few tables and model the triples in the store, and then we'll be able to put it in the store here quite a bit more flexibly. And then also, similarly, we're really going to be looking at how do I access. So it's complicated because it used to be I went to an item and dspace.data model was fixed. I know that items have double four, so I know if I go to an item, I can ask for this double four because it's published, they all have it. But if I have learning objects supported in dspace and I go to an item, it may or may not have learning object metadata. And so I have to have some way that I can figure out that I can negotiate with this object and say, what kind of metadata do you have? And this is a step that I need to execute even before I'm able to issue queries into the system. And then up here, to speak to the gentleman's point, I also need to have services that can do this stuff for me. They can do that. This is ways that it's useful. Now, there are a lot of unresolved architectural questions here, such as, in the long term, can you replace the relational database with this RDF store, or are they complements? Or is all the source information held here in a persistent genodoc, persistent genodoc repository, and this is serving more like a cache of it. It's more efficient along a particular axis of operation. No hard decisions. I think so. As we do these demonstrations, we're going to generate some of the data that we need to be able to make this decision. This is just a sampling of the use cases that we're considering. And we're interested in your use cases too. So this is grounded at MIT, but if you think you're coming from a community where the things that I've been saying up here really kind of hit home, I would encourage you to stop by and introduce yourself. So, support for learning objects, course materials essentially, there's a particular schema of SCORM or IMS that merged, right?
SCORM and both IMS.
Yeah, so, okay. And so there's a particular schema, it's, you know, it's more complicated than double core, suffice it to say. Course management systems are going to be generating this information. Both the course that I'm on, these are going to be generating this information. Another is visual images. So there's a kind of a complement to Bellin 4 called VRA 4 that we hope to be able to support. We talked about authority control services where I ship off my baby data to this third party and they ship it back, an improved version. And then in the dspace system, I have to decide what to do with these two versions of the instance of Bellin 4. Kind of right out of the gate, you need a way to register a schema and be able to find it and visualize it. And there have been some efforts in that area to date, but we think that we're going to need something like that with these spaces. History system might also properly be called the audit system. Roger talks about the data provenance of both the content objects and the metadata about them and how they change over time as they're administered within the system. David Carter's really interested in annotations, not in the metadata, but its content, right? So what if in a library system you were tracking lots of system usage data, like what kinds of queries were people running, and how happy are they with their results, and then you can mine that and actually use that as a data source to offer some new services. Biomedical, we talked about brain slices. Kind of interesting, both because the assets, the images themselves, are pretty big. And so there's interesting storage distribution problems there. But also because the way that you describe a brain slice is really different from the way you describe a picture of a scene or a picture of a building. And so they're an interesting scheme of diversity. And then distributed collections. So these are things that we're actually thinking of building, this like little 3 month thing. So step one, let's go get instance metadata in a bunch of schemas and like have it so that we can look at them all. People like to talk about metadata and schema interoperability, but it's remarkably difficult to actually get people to produce their schemas and metadata. And so this is work that I think so needs to be done. Once you have it, then you can run some experiments to say, if I wanted to query across different schemas, could I do that even in a very controlled situation and see what kind of results you get? And so we would use either OWL or GELM plus OWL to try to make that happen. When you talk about that box in the architecture diagram where applications essentially are negotiating with content, asking about what kinds of metadata do you have, what kinds of content views do you have, and we like to prototype. There's a lot of priority in this area that we can leverage from. The examine distribution mechanism, what if the content's not all in one place? What if I have a metadata store that is on my laptop and I want it to work together with the metadata store that I have in my IT library? How cool is that? Can we just straight up take this DSpace relational database that you saw over there that had the data model and double core, and can we just do something really, really simple, like model those database tables using RDF and then see what kinds of query RDF queries we might be able to run against that and get some interesting characterization performance metrics. So I have all this RDF and I've got tables and I've got instances. There are some significant UI concerns here because the way that you currently interact with these systems is through query languages like Squish or RDQL, and it's very computer science oriented. You've got to know what you're doing. And it's not really very user friendly. So it might be really instructional to just build some navigator viewer kinds of things and let people serve this data over magnitude or more easily. RDFdiff, I've got this graph. And that graph, I mean, it's different. Semantic web processing model. So this has come up in XML space, but not yet in RDF space. And we're interested in how much energy needs to be spent here. The fundamental issue is if I've got this graph and it's got an embedded URN and URI and it might be referring to a schema, but how do I tell? And if it's referring to a schema, then where am I going to get the schema? Because there's no acknowledged best practice there. Sometimes the URI is in fact a URL, and I can resolve it and expect to find a schema there. But that's not always the case. And so you need some acknowledged, like both sides of the transaction best practices there. If we expect that issues are going to come up when we start actually putting these things together. In the same way that you could. This is just about giving an instance view, giving an RDF scheme and giving a piece of code that can generically show me an instance of it, maybe let me edit it. We've got a sister system in DSpace that's generating all this RDF, and we've got an effort currently underway to improve the quality of the RDF that it's generating, and we'd like to hook that up to eStack and provide a way to view and navigate the provenance information that's coming from DSpace. People familiar with the preservation community know what OAIS stands for. This is Open Archival Information System Reference Specification. So this is a spec that says, if you want to keep things around for 50 years or 100 years, what are the kinds of metadata that you need to be gathering? And what are the kinds of agreements that you need to have with people that are submitting stuff in and with people who are going to be taking stuff out the other end? And it turns out that if you want to follow this model, there's a lot of administrative metadata that's going to get generated in the process of following it. And we're not yet aware of anybody who said, let's codify those into the schema, such that anybody who wanted to implement an OAIS compliant repository could just use the schemas and populate the instances and off you go. So this is a demonstrator who said, if you want it to be OAIS compliant, what would the schema do? Scheme registry submission. process. Okay, so I've got my schema. I want to be able to come up to Richard and say, please allow me to accept, please accept instances of this schema. So what do I do, both from an organizational point of view and from a technology point of view? Okay, with this like long list of techniques, it's really cool if A, you can actually succeed in doing some of these individual points, and it's even better if you can chain them together and say, every time somebody submits a work in this collection, this PDF, I want you to extract the text, and then I want you to like search the text for things that look like authors, and I want you to annotate the double core if you find something. This requires some kind of a map-based workflow system. It's a little bit off axis for Simile. So we're looking for good open source web-based workflow systems if you know one of us now. So we'll scope that a task and do a survey and see if we can find one. Then archival Simile data. This is referring to implementation of the Mets archival information package that you referred to. When an item comes into vSpace, is there a way that you can bundle up either for archival or for export and interchange with a like-minded repository the contents of that item? And again, that requires a schema and some agreement about how to do that. That's all about Simile. It's a lot of work. Let me just go back to, okay, where are we at? Where are we at? So about February, we got our funding. It's about $3.5 million for 3 years. So we've got room to build actually a reasonable team here. The PIs I introduced, we've been doing all this work in capturing the use cases, doing decomposition on, you know, what are the sub-problems that are actually involved here. And these candidate prototype demonstrators. There's some research staff that we need that are not yet in place, and so we're going to be doing hiring there. It's coming. That might be another thing that we want to talk about if you know people that might be interested in this kind of work. And we're hoping to have these first demonstrators out the door by the end of the year. We scope them as sort of 3 month activities. We're confident that
it's 2003.
Yeah. You know, good eye. I'm still here. Well, thank you for your patience. We're well over time. If anyone has questions, feel free to. Yes?
So, during the project store for the that you're going to turn out that small data into storage of Postgres, is that what you said?
Well, so with an RDS store, there's kind of two issues. One is the API, how you talk to it. And Jenna is really an API to an RDS data model. And Jenna also has capabilities for persistence. So you can persist those models in one of several backends. So currently Jenna supports a Berkeley DB backend, which is the SleepyCat database, or a Postgres backend. And then the Genesis team that I mentioned in Palo Alto is developing a third, that I think will have some nice performance there.
That's fine.
There's definitely overlap there, and so Globus and the SRD work that Richard mentioned, I think have a lot of overlap in commonality and probably be a very highly distributed network. Yeah, that's a spot on the vision.
About the RDS store, can you give more details on Postgres storage in Vietnam?
So, I would be the wrong person to take that up. That would be probably someone from the Genesis team. But it is detailed in some of the Genesis documentation. So yeah, if you want to follow up,
the reason I'm interested is that because I'm doing my own RDF to relational translation there and some of that. So yeah, that's something I would like to see how other people do the same.
You bet. If you want to maybe trade cards at the end, you can
do that.
Thank you all.
Yes.